about 7 pages single space, which equals 14 pages double space, which translates to about 28-minute sermon. I labored and labored to cut it down because I love you guys. So we're looking at 15 minutes, still considerably longer than Brian, but I think doable. So again, sorry to be a disappointment. Just how does one adequately follow Cindy's uplifting series on the fruits of the Spirit? But with a sermon on God and hatred, of course. Of course. As Dietrich Bonhoeffer once stated, absolute seriousness is never without a dash of humor. Now we can jump right into our text from Proverbs and the seven deadly sins to see just what exactly God hates. But that would prove to be both overkill and, besides, today's point. So let us instead focus our increasingly short attention spans on the fascinating and never preached on text of Revelation 2. What makes this particular text so fascinating is that in a way it kind of makes for a choose-your-own-adventure sermon, as it elicits two separate exegetical paths, both holding considerable merit to our question at hand: is God capable of hatred? So let us have some fun then and venture down each path, playing the devil's advocate, seeing in the end which path we prefer. Path one goes like this: if we believe in the complete authority of Scripture and the divine ordinance of every word that is contained within, even down to the very roots of their etymology, assassinate Hitler, to rid the world of the root of evil. But there, for now, I digress. Surely then, if this first path is true, and God were to be found capable of hating anything or anyone, it would certainly be these Nicolaitan types who have existed throughout the age of time, right up until our present day, be it behind the mask of red or blue candidacy, or Presbyterian or Catholic leadership. Anyone who distracts the people from the truth by diluting revelation seems ripe for God's wrath. While wrath is echoed in this church. Now, if we're to be philosophically honest, this first path does not come to its end without having its share of sinkholes along the way. For if we ascribe absolute authoritative value to Revelation 2, arguing that God had expressed intent behind the etymology of the word Nicolaitan, so to better articulate the range of divine hatred, then we must also open the floodgates to every other biblical text that directly or indirectly affirms God's vitriol in so many words. How can we line veto our way through Scripture and maintain a sense of spiritual integrity? Are we then truly ready to follow this first path and put all of the Levitical laws back on the table? Are we sure we want to resurrect Timothy and silence women in church? Or to remove from them their earrings? Perhaps then it would be prudent to also consider our second exegetical path this morning. Even if perhaps it is more uncomfortable than our first. For this second path asserts that God is not capable of hatred, for hatred is a human construct, and that Scripture itself is an untrustworthy resource when considering divine emotion, as it is but the work of mankind, a species. very straight here. It's probably where I'd normally end the sermon, but I slowed down a little bit more. So let me just set the record straight. I actually kind of like John. And I adore Revelation. It's kooky, it's funny, it's different than any other text. We all should love it. So before we let path two here defame John's name too much, let us consider the possibility that John perhaps suffered from what all of our biology share, something called the binary instinct. Rush Dozer Jr., in his landmark book, Why We Hate, diagrams this binary instinct and describes it as such, and I quote, "We humans have an innate tendency called the binary instinct to divide the world into us and them. It is a way for us to create order in a world otherwise overwhelming in flux and detail. The combination of generalization and us versus them mentality interferes with our ability to empathize with those in the them group. And this lack of empathy is one of the most surprising and disturbing aspects of hate." If I haven't watched it yet, I probably will in this next paragraph, but listen closely. "Furthermore, it is meaning rather than instinct that is so overwhelmingly important to our human species that our limbic system," you guys are gone, "that our limbic system has evolved a powerful tendency to blindly to seek truth instead of falsehoods, to seek love instead of hate. For as Bonhoeffer himself once said in one of the earlier theological visions that he had, the followers of Christ have been called to peace. And they must not only have peace, but also make peace. And to that end, they renounce all violence and tumult. In the case of Christ, nothing is to be gained by such methods. His disciples keep the peace by choosing to endure suffering themselves rather than to inflict it on others. They maintain fellowship where others would break it off. They renounce hatred and wrong, and in so doing, they overcome evil with good and establish the peace of God in the midst of a war, a world of war and hate. In closing, one might argue that I have given you two contradictory paths, as well as two contradictory shades of Bonhoeffer, and that in the end, I have left you more confused and frustrated about this question of divine hatred than from whence we started. You might also hold it against me that the idea of a religiousless Christianity, as espoused at the end of our first path, does not meet and agree from which we just read at the end of our second path. Namely, religiousless Christianity doesn't gel with the maintaining of our Christian fellowship. Nor, might you say, does renouncing all violence and tumult fully compute with Bonhoeffer's ulterior plan to assassinate Hitler, which I alluded to earlier in support of a differing point. And to all this, I confess that I am guilty as charged and consciously so. But might I offer just this last witness into testimony. So far in my rather short but somewhat full 30 years, I have come to learn that most of what we have in this existence are shades and apparitions of clarity. There are simply things about us and life that will always be rendered contradictory and in need of reconciliation and the attribution of meaning. And in similar unyielding frequency, there are those things that we will just never come to know or fully understand, especially and perhaps greatest of which, the range and scope of God's emotions. All then that we are given are several paths, and if we're lucky, several answers toward illumination, but not of illumination, thereby forever eliciting the need for further research into which path and answer we'll be able to say just might.